the state presses pause on reopening. A mask-wearing ad campaign, plus Todd Young on DACA, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 3rd, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced Indiana will largely press pause on its reopening plan instead of moving to the final phase this weekend. The state was set to enter Stage 5, which imposed virtually no restrictions on store and restaurant capacities or gathering sizes. Instead, Holcomb says current capacity and gathering limits will remain for another 2 weeks.
This gives all of us a little more additional time to manage our way through this.
Holcomb says he's pressing pause because of recent upticks in hospitalization rates and the percentage of Hoosiers testing positive for the virus.
It's a very volatile environment out there around the country, and it is in the state of Indiana as well. We're not immune to that fact.
However, in what Holcomb calls Stage 4.5, fairs, festivals, carnivals, and conventions will be allowed to reopen for the first time, provided they follow some COVID-19 safety precautions. Will Hoosiers be okay with a pause in reopening? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody, state government reporter for the Indianapolis Business Journal. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, Indiana has been moving progressively to open more and more on the timeline it had set. In fact, it's gone a little early to each stage so far. So because cooperation is really the thing that makes this work, will Hoosiers cooperate with the state pressing pause?
Well, I certainly hope so, because I think it's the right move. I mean, we have seen hospitalizations go up, and certainly we've seen what's happening around the country. And it is frightening when the South and the West, and certain areas in the West, opened early. We see the results of that, and we certainly don't want to see something like that happen here. So I think the pause is warranted, and I think it also helps to tell people that this isn't behind us yet. We're not even through the first phase of this yet, and so we need to keep taking the precautions that have been outlined by the CDC.
Mike, do you think Hoosiers are ready to press pause on this reopening plan that the governor laid out a couple months ago now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, I think we've been opening methodically and gradually. I think people are starting to sense some normalness coming back to their lives and the economy and society. But remember, this was always an exercise, and Governor Holcomb said from the beginning that they would manage this based on the data that they see. We still have 40% of ICU beds available, 83% of ventilators available. They want to maintain and manage that capacity if people start getting really sick again and need that hospital capacity and need to get care to save them. That was always the metric that mattered. It was, are people dying who shouldn't have if they had access to health care, if the healthcare system wasn't overwhelmed? So that's always been the exercise in this or the data point that mattered the most. And so the governor was exactly right in hitting the pause button and continuing to lengthen the time frame a little bit on fully reopening.
John Schwanes, this was stage 4.5. He didn't just entirely pause everything. He said fairs, festivals, carnivals, and conventions, as long as they follow certain social distancing guidelines, could all proceed forward for the first time since the state first shut down due to COVID-19. Do you think it makes sense to, on the one hand, say, we don't like where a couple of our numbers are, so let's just hold off on opening everything, while at the same time saying, but all of these large public events can go forward?
From a public health standpoint, probably doesn't make much sense. From the standpoint of somebody who's trying to govern a state, maintain a coalition and support, especially just a few months before a reelection bid is put to voters, I'd say that makes common sense. That, again, we've talked early and often on this show about the need to balance safety and precaution with the realities of real world existence. And I think the governor is doing the best he can to try to walk that very fine line. It's you're seeing more and more Republican office holders, even those who come from the very conservative factions of the party, taking it upon themselves to say, wear masks, you know, be careful, do things that, you know, practice these, if not full-blown lockdown, at least be smart about social distancing. And it's not a wussy thing to do. So perhaps some people will listen to that. You'll still have some people, though, to answer your earlier question, who think this is still a trial run for some sort of effort for the New World Order to make sure how compliant society is. And you'll still have, regardless of what happens, we'll still have individuals who believe that that's the case.
Lindsay or Doty, the governor has talked all along through the COVID shutdown and then the reopening plan that he was going to look at the data and the numbers, like both Ann and Mike have said, and make decisions based on that. Do you think, could you foresee a time when Holcomb has to start reimposing restrictions for the first time?
I think it would depend on where we're at with those four guiding principles that he's talked about all along, like you mentioned. I think given that what, you know, John just talked about, that it is an election year, Governor Holcomb is a Republican in a very Republican state. I think a lot of people would not be thrilled to see more restrictions come back in and for us to go backwards. So I'm not sure we'll see that happen. But then again, if the numbers get really bad and, you know, he can't point at any of those four principles and show us moving in the right direction, then I think he'd have a hard time justifying staying where we are or continuing to reopen.
Well, the state of Indiana is launching a public service campaign to urge Hoosiers to wear a mask when in public to help reduce the spread of COVID-19. But the governor is still resisting calls to require mask wearing.
Other states, notably Arizona, Florida, and Texas, have recently seen alarming surges of COVID-19. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says she hopes Hoosiers see what's happening in those states as proof they need to wear a mask when in public.
Indiana could very easily be in that same situation in the next 2 to 4 weeks or 6 weeks if we don't take this to heart.
Still, Governor Eric Holcomb won't mandate mask wearing.
Because I believe in Hoosiers, and I believe that Hoosiers are doing the right thing for the most part.
Yet Holcomb says he supports local governments and individual businesses that decide to impose their own mask wearing requirements.
Mike O'Brien, quite frankly, is believing Hoosiers will do the right thing a sound strategy?
Well, it's probably the only one available to them. Look, I mean, if you have people that are indignant about mask wearing, they're going to be more indignant when the government tells them they have to do it, right? I mean, so like he's trying, and it's not necessarily appropriate everywhere. I mean, so we look at these hot spots around the country in Florida, Arizona, and Texas that were named in the lead up here. We also know that those states have made terrible decisions about locking down and beach closures in Florida. And I mean, there's a direct line that you can draw between what's happening in those states and the reason why and the delays in managing this crisis. And so it's just because we see surges in Arizona doesn't mean that we should require mask wearing in Logansport. You know, it can't fit that way. And so the governor is smartly relied on local leaders. Mayor Joe Hogg said this week, said that Marion County is going to be required next week to wear masks. And that's how it's got to go. This has got to be about personal responsibility in a state that seems to value that that principle in their politics and manage it that way.
And Delaney, to Mike's point, would Eric Holcomb getting up right now and saying, I'm mandating mask wearing, really make that much of a difference?
Oh, I think it would, actually. It would show some leadership in the way Joe Hogsett has already shown in Marion County. I think the problem with it is nobody wants to see people fined or people put in jail for not wearing masks or anything like that. But a consistent message that mask wearing matters, when you have an inconsistent message coming from the White House and the governor not willing to stand up and say wear masks, I think really makes it more difficult for employers, because the employers are going to be employees are going to say, well, why should I wear one when the governor says you don't have to? That kind of thing. It really makes no sense for him not to come out and say, we've done a decent job of keeping this virus in check in Indiana. We want to continue that, even though we're seeing surges elsewhere where people didn't wear masks. So please, as a matter of patriotism and individual responsibility, wear masks.
Lindsay, here at Indianapolis, Mike just referenced that Mayor Joe Hogsett said that Marion County, starting next week, Hoosiers here in Marion County will be required to wear masks. Do you think that will have much of an impact here locally?
I guess we'll see what happens. It's hard to say, although I do know, judging by the comments that were on our story that we ran after the announcement was made, there were a lot of people that said, I'm still not going to wear a mask. And I think one of the interesting things, kind of to what Anne was saying, is I'm very curious how this is going to be enforced. Is someone going to stop me if I'm out and about and I don't have a mask on? What are the fines really going to be? At one point, it seems like the fines could be $1,000, which seems pretty steep for not wearing a mask, but that's also the standard fine for not complying with, you know, a public health policy. I think there are still a lot of questions about the Indianapolis policy that haven't been answered yet.
John Schwanis, you can't remove politics from anything, really, especially not in an election year. So what do the politics look like for Eric Holcomb on deciding whether or not to say, even if there aren't, to Lindsay's point, a lot of we're going to fine you or put you in jail, which I don't think anybody really wants. What are the politics like of just getting up and saying, I'm going to make it mandatory for you to wear a mask?
You know, there's this, I think Hoosiers have this, or many Hoosiers have a natural aversion to what some would describe as the nanny state, the notion that we're going to keep you safe by telling you when to wear seatbelts, when you can talk in your cell phones, you know, whether you need to wear helmets when you ride your motorcycles or not. You know, these are ongoing issues, public health concerns notwithstanding. So I think the calculation here is politically, it probably would not be advantageous at this point. I also think echo what Mike said, I'm not sure there's really any other alternative because of the impracticality associated with trying to enforce something like this. I do think that the carrot approach is probably better than the stick. You know, I heard a pundit, might have been David Axelrod, I hope I give him credit if that's who deserved it, who said that Donald Trump, for instance, missed a great business opportunity, or his campaign did. If they had sold MAGID masks, you know, they could have been sitting on millions of dollars in far more popular than any bumper sticker probably or coffee mug they had ever sold. It does seem to be an interesting opportunity for advertisers, for marketers. I know Indiana University, two of my kids were excited this week to know that see the mask design that IU is coming out with for all students next fall, or this very soon, I should say. And my son, who's an alum, was wondering where he could get his. So there's power in sort of tribal and marketing aspects of this. It seems that maybe people will catch on to.
Well, we hope so. Wear a mask. It's just that simple. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, would more people wear masks if mask wearing were mandatory? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, we asked you if police unions' collective bargaining rights should be curtailed. Only 38% said yes, 62% of you said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, U.S. Senator Todd Young says he supports a path to legal status for DACA recipients, known as Dreamers, as part of a broader immigration reform package. The U.S. Supreme Court recently prevented the Trump administration from ending the DACA program, but only temporarily. Senator Young says there are a variety of immigration challenges the U.S. needs to tackle, including better security at the southern border. But he says DACA recipients who were brought to the U.S. as children shouldn't be penalized. He supports a path to legal status.
That may be citizenship. It may not. My expectation is that it would be difficult over a longer period of time to sustain some sort of legal status that is not citizenship.
Young isn't confident, however, that any deal can be reached before the November election.
It's unfortunate to say it, but politics is trumping good policy and long-delayed policy in this case.
Young says nothing's more important than providing Dreamers with some measure of certainty. John Schwanis, is the reality that Dreamers are simply going to have to wait a while longer for any sort of permanent solution?
Well, the bad news certainly for them is that they will have to wait at least probably until after November because it is such a politically charged issue that I'm not sure anyone really wants to expend the political capital right now to make something significant happen. However, the good news for them is that it will happen and eventually. It's just a matter of when, not if. You look at the role that these workers play in the U.S. economy. They're essential. There's just no two ways about it. And some of them are so deeply rooted in society. You know, they came here maybe as children before they even were cognizant of what was going on. You've heard, you know, that's thousands of instances of that. There's no way to remove them. So it's going to happen. I think we're getting back to sort of where we were, maybe with some practical solutions back before the Trump election, maybe, you know, back in those days when people like Dick Lugar and, well, he was one, but lots of prominent Republicans in the House and Senate were already had put together plans that for Dreamers and other individuals who could enjoy long citizenship or legal residency here if they jump through the right hoops.
Lindsay, we were talking a lot about DACA a couple years ago when the Trump administration first was talking about and tried to end the program, and then it died down as the court battle played out. With this recent ruling from the Supreme Court, keeping the program alive at least a little bit longer, do you think that reignites the debate in a way that we see any movement before November, or is this, like John just said, something that just has to wait until at least theoretically January then?
I think John's probably right that, I mean, we might see some debate about it, and I think there's a desire to have some sort of a solution. I don't think everyone agrees on what that solution is, but I think there's a desire to have a solution. I'm just not sure everyone's going to come to an agreement on that before November. And you think about some of the other things that are going on and kind of taking priority right now with the, you know, coronavirus and the calls for police reform. I'm just not sure this is going to, you know, really rise to the top and be able to see negotiations before, like you said, January. And even after that, I'm not sure how quick we would have a solution, depending on, you know, who's controlling Congress and who's controlling the White House and whether or not those are the same parties or not.
Yeah. And in talking to Todd Young, I asked him whether or not the Dreamer portion of the DACA portion of this should maybe be separate from the broader immigration discussion and a broader immigration reform package that I think both parties agree we need, maybe differing on how we get there. But he said that it's harder to do something this comprehensive and this big by doing it in little pieces. Is he right there? Do we need to have one big answer?
No, I think he's right about breaking it up, because I think that the DACA situation is the most sympathetic of all of them. I mean, these people have been in this country so long that their parents are U.S. citizens now. And, you know, soon they'll be grandparents of U.S. citizens. And we still haven't resolved their legal dilemma. They need a path to citizenship, but it's not going to happen until Mitch McConnell is no longer the leader of the Senate and until Donald Trump is no longer in the White House. So after January, I think we have a real shot of doing something that is comprehensive and includes that which is most sympathetic, and that is the plight of the Dreamers.
Mike, we just, you know, Ann just referenced this as a particularly sympathetic part of this debate. We heard John say it's probably a matter of when as opposed to if. Why then, and Todd Young, this is not a new position for Todd Young either, who's a prominent Republican in the Senate. He's been saying this for a while now. Why is it then, is it so hard to get a deal on this particular program?
Well, if we don't trust Hoosiers to wear masks, I'm not going to trust Congress to fix this in the next 3 months before a presidential election. Todd Young is exactly right. I mean, this is a very practical solution to a very real problem, which is providing a path to citizenship for people who are here. The problem you have is you have the far right who believe in walls and deportation, and the answer to that on the far left is defunding ICE and a borderless country. And so somewhere in the middle,
Michael,
people who have people
true.
On the far
that's
left and the far
true.
Right, that's absolutely right. Are you, that's,
abs-
that's exactly what they say. But what I'm talking about is
they don't want the wall. That doesn't mean they don't want a border.
What I'm saying are the 80% of the people in the middle need to figure this out and come to a solution on what should happen, and that Dreamers ought to have a realistic path to citizenship. I mean, you ask these people where they came from, the answer is Cincinnati. It's not Mexico or... You know, it's unbelievable, and it's impractical. And if you're a conservative, you do not want a big government that can systematically extract 20 million people from society and send them somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, Hoosiers will finally get to know about COVID cases and deaths at individual nursing homes after state officials announced this week they will finally begin to publish facility-level long-term care data later this month.
All of Indiana's neighboring states and a growing number of states across the country have made similar data public. The Indiana State Department of Health provided talking points to local health departments during a webinar last month about what to say if a person or agency requested any data. Officials say now is the time to release more information because the state has resources to better analyze it. Dr. Dan Rosiniak, the state's point person on long-term care facilities, says mitigation and prevention remain the top priorities.
As we have all learned, responding to this pandemic requires us to continually evaluate our approaches and, when appropriate, to change them. This is one of those times.
The state says it will take about a month to compile and build a database.
Lindsay, I think you and I were pretty surprised by this announcement. Did the state give any sort of indication as to why now is finally the time?
I agree that it is fair to say we were both pretty surprised by that announcement. Happy about it, but surprised. Reporters have repeatedly asked for this information really since the pandemic started and have repeatedly been told that the data didn't exist or couldn't be provided for privacy reasons. And the reasons that we were given with the announcement were that some of the associations representing the nursing homes and the AARP representing some of the residents in these nursing home facilities have said it's okay to release this kind of data and that they support that. They did not mention the fact that reporters have been pushing for this for months, or the fact that, you know, I think it's becoming a little bit harder to justify the privacy argument when so many other states have released it.
Yeah, John Schwanes, what do you think is the real reason why we're going to finally get this data?
Well, maybe I'll go back to what I repeat what I said in the last question. It was inevitable. It was going to happen because of the precedent that's been set elsewhere in the country, because of Indiana statute, because of the fact that so much of long-term care is financed with public funds through Medicare and Medicaid. There were news organizations, I'm sure, that already were putting together databases that were based on readily available records, death certificates, and so forth. I mean, you could put this together. So why would the state, it seems to me, want to look like it was an obstacle to knowledge and transparency, something that we purport to advocate and support, when it was going to get out eventually anyway? So it was going to happen.
And Delaney, does it matter less that it took this long and more that we're going to finally get it?
I think it matters that it took this long and took this much heat. These are organizations that they cite have been asking for this information for months, okay? They finally got enough political pressure behind it from the legislators and from the media that they finally released it. There was no excuse for not releasing it earlier. When people are making decisions about where to place loved ones and you don't have the basic information, is awful. It's just awful. So it's about time they put it out, and they should have put it out when first asked back months ago.
Yeah. Mike, does it make the Holcomb administration look worse now that they're finally doing it, that they waited so long?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's right that they've had to change their approach to releasing some of this data. I mean, 2 months ago, right when it came out of my mouth 2 months ago, in my defense of keeping this confidential, I knew that would be one of the most poorly aged comments that ever made on this show. It turned out to be true. I think the nursing home side of this is clearly the most poorly handled from the nursing home standpoint and the state standpoint. Of this, because in terms of communication back to families and just communication in general has been poor, and I think they're trying to correct it.
All right. Well, a federal judge halted the state's new panhandling law before it took effect this week, calling it an unconstitutional prohibition on the freedom of speech.
The new measure makes it a crime to ask for money within 50 feet of where financial transactions are made, ATMs, banks, stores, and parking meters. That effectively bans panhandling in downtown Indianapolis and other large cities. The ACLU of Indiana sued, arguing the legislation was so restrictive that its staff couldn't solicit contributions for memberships on Monument Circle in Indianapolis every September 17th on Constitution Day. And Judge Jane Magnus Stinson agreed, saying the case was, quote, not a close call. She wrote that the state attorney general's office failed to provide evidence linking panhandling to business disruptions or escalations in criminal behavior.
And Eleni, we are almost out of time, so quickly, and I know this is hard to do quickly perhaps, but how do we address the issue of panhandling now?
I think what we have to do, I mean, Judge Stinson's correct. This is settled case law, okay? The fact that they passed it was ridiculous. What we need to do is devote more resources to mental health and social services downtown with the homeless population so that we're not asking the police to do that. That's been the cry, the rallying cry in the Black Lives Matter movement, and we ought to do it right here in Indianapolis. Other jurisdictions have done it successfully, so can we.
Well, devoting more funding to anything right now seems to be a difficult conversation to have and might be for the time, for going forward at least for a while. And that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody of the Indianapolis Business Journal. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.